Movie theaters are modern-day pulpits. Real-world theology exists to shed a light on the narratives that are shaping our culture and to remind viewers that entertainment is not mindless.
Welcome to Real World Theology, episode 135, where we tag team with Steve Norton from Screenfish and director Paul Muzzin. So listen up, because we've got a really covenantal show for you. On this episode, we talk Alien, Covenant, and standing in for God.
Welcome to the podcast. We are so excited this week to talk about Alien, Covenant. And for this film, we went out and got a couple of heavy hitters for you. We are so excited to have back Mikey Fissel from Real World Theology. Welcome, Mikey.
What's up, man?
Glad to have you back. And we're also happy to have Paul Muzzin, director Paul Muzzin. Am I saying your name right?
Yeah, man.
Okay. Welcome, Paul. Glad to have you on.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here.
This week we're going to be talking about Ridley Scott's very divisive Alien Covenant. The latest entry into, I want to say his Alien franchise, but it really isn't. It's sort of a different direction. But Alien Covenant follows on the events after Prometheus, where the ship, the Covenant, hears a distress call and lands on an alien planet, and mayhem ensues. And before we do, just a reminder that this podcast is totally open for spoilers. So we're going to be discussing the film quite openly, and you should be aware of that if you haven't seen the film, and if just so you know when we get started. But guys, I thought that as we get started, maybe you can talk a little bit. What is it about the how do you feel about the Alien franchise? Are you fans? Is it something that has been interesting to you? What do you think? Whoever wants to go, Paul, why don't you tell us?
I was like, wow, that's a great silence. What does that really say about our views? I'll be honest, not a big fan of the Alien franchise, mainly because growing up, I wasn't really into horror. And I know it took a bit of a turn from horror to action, but yeah, it's just not my cup of tea. Now, that being said, I really love Prometheus. There is a lot of great depth in terms of the storytelling and the themes that I think Ridley Scott was trying to get across, and the screenwriters being said as well. And so that actually drew me back into wanting to see these other films again. And so in the last week before I went to see Alien Covenant, I binged Alien, Aliens, and Prometheus just to make sure that I was putting myself in that right space.
Well, that's interesting, because I think I had to be when I was like in late middle, maybe high school, but Aliens was one of those movies that came on like TNT or something all the time, or, you know, like Sci-Fi Channel or whatever it was that I had access to in those formative years of my life. And I remember I saw Aliens, I feel like, so many times, and I really enjoyed it. Like it was scary, but it wasn't too scary. Because I was able to pull some sci-fi away from it. I thought it was incredibly imaginative, and in, you know, that weird kind of way, I thought it was a lot of fun. It was basically like someone made a video game, and that to me, again, at that time of my life, was incredibly cool. The thing is, maybe ironically, that I didn't actually get to, or even try to seek out to see Alien, oh man, probably until somewhere in the 7 to 8 years ago range. I mean, like, I'd seen Aliens many times. I saw Alien 3. I saw Alien Resurrection. And I never actually watched the first Alien movie. And you know what?
You saw Resurrection before the first Alien movie?
Yeah, well, it was one of those things that, for some reason in my brain, I thought I had seen it. I'd seen Aliens so many times, I was like, surely I'm mixing it up, and some of those things that happen in Aliens, that's actually from Alien, surely, you know, like I said, I just didn't know. It was before I started being a little more deliberate with the movies that I watched and kind of how I engage entertainment and think about it like that. So I just kind of assumed that I'd seen it. So I went and watched all the sequels, and it wasn't until someone was describing in detail, like, remember this scene in Alien? And I was like, no. I was like, but what about that? They're like, that's Aliens. I was like, yeah, but what about this? They're like, that's still Aliens. And they're like, but you obviously remember this part, right? I was like, oh, yeah, yeah. Well, I obviously remember that part because that's what Spaceballs made fun of. So
yeah.
Yeah, so yeah. I knew that. But they were like, well, yeah, but you didn't have to see the movie to see that part. I was like, oh, yeah. So we all sat down, we watched it, and I was like, you know what? I have never seen this movie, and it is great, and I think I would have enjoyed it even more if I hadn't, you know, obviously seen all the ones that came after it. So, I don't care. I think it's general consensus. I don't care for Alien 3 or Alien Resurrection really at all. Like if I never see them again, at least at this point in my life, I don't feel like I'm missing anything.
But does anybody?
But that's what I'm saying. I think that's general consensus, right? But, you know, we went to see Prometheus. We were really excited. I was really captivated by it for probably the first half or two thirds. And then I just didn't really understand what Ridley Scott was trying to do. And it kind of lost me a bit, though. I think I enjoyed it more than consensus opinion did. So, you know, I saw the trailers for Alien Covenant and I was like, you know what? Yeah, I enjoyed Prometheus enough. I'll give this one a shot. So, you know, I mean, like, I don't consider, like, the Alien franchise, like, one of my top franchises ever. But I am, I'm an easy mark for sci-fi. And when I'm so into, or I'm such an easy mark for sci-fi that if anyone can even give me a glimmer of hope that they're going to make good sci-fi, or horror sci-fi or adventure sci-fi, as long as it, you know, has that and, then I'll give them a shot to do it. I'll give them a shot to impress me or entertain me. And that's what I think when I see an advertisement for an Alien film, you know, if Ridley Scott makes another one, which I'm sure he probably will, because there's still some time in the timeline to fill, I'll probably go give it a chance too. So, you know, not a favorite, but I definitely don't not like it. Wherever that middle ground is.
I definitely don't not like it.
Yeah. That's the thing. Alien, I think, is great. I don't really want to watch Alien that often, but I'll still watch. I think Aliens is just a fun movie to watch. And I will still watch that. So it's one of those things where, like, you know, a movie, there's movies in the series that I really enjoy, and then there's movies that I could really never care again to see. So, if you do the mathematical average of that, it's okay. That's like the number equivalent of whatever that is.
Yeah, that's fair. I my heart breaks. I'm one of the great defenders of Alien 3. I really am. I think that it works with the three movies, because even though it's totally wildly different in so many ways. Mm-hmm. It continues to develop the story and her and evolve Ripley in a way that I thought was really interesting. I got to admit, the Alien, I can't stand horror movies. I've never liked horror movies, but the Alien franchise is one of those ones that has a place in my heart. And I think it's because, yeah, I saw Aliens first. I remember I was about 19 and my buddy said, you got to see this. We got to sit down and watch this movie. I'm like, whatever. Like, okay, sure, fine. So he rented it, I think, and we watched it on a VHS, you know, state of the art. And I was like, what in the heck? This is so great. Then I saw the original, and then I saw Alien 3, and I love those movies. Alien 4 Alien Resurrection is a steaming pile of monkey crap.
Well, that's so incredible, right? Because so Alien 3, even though general, like they said, again, the general consensus is most people don't like it. It's directed by David Fincher, who
I know
by all accounts is one of the most creative or best, however, whatever adjective you want to use to make it sound like he's outstanding, you know, directors of all time. And then Alien Resurrection, for the steaming pile that it is, was written by Joss Whedon.
No.
It is.
You break my heart. Are right? you kidding me?
So, like, it's so like two of my favorite filmmakers were involved in two movies that I probably could be, I could not care less to see again.
I'm in shock right now. I had no idea that Whedon was involved.
Yeah.
Now it's my favorite movie. No. Alien Resurrection is a superior film to all the, no.
That explains why there's so many vampires in Resurrection.
Dude. There's no explanation for Resurrection. There's so many everythings in Resurrection. See, you know, this is the thing. Something terrible happened right after Alien 3. And I know not everybody likes Alien 3. And I know even Neil Blomkamp, you know, sitting down during the filming of Chappie, which, you know, is the grand work of art that it is, but working with Sigourney, and they're saying, he says, I've got this great idea. And even he wanted to take it right back to the end of Aliens. Like, he wanted to erase Alien 3 and 4. But then they did Alien versus the Predator movies, which are just horrendous. I know some people are like, oh, they're great. I can't even stomach them.
I wouldn't use the word great.
Yeah. And I mean, really, like, any movie that's something versus something, exactly. Is it really going to be good?
I think Paul's like all over this one. Like, the versus basically means guilty pleasure. That's like the movie, you know, pen name of guilty pleasure.
Like the movie version of The Bachelor, essentially, right? It's like, yeah. You're going to like this, but you know you shouldn't be watching it.
Like, right? this is something that you should hate and don't tell your friends, but you know all your friends are watching it too.
That's right.
I went to the theater to see Alien versus Predator.
You know what? I remember when Alien versus Predator came out, they released a 2-minute clip online of the alien fighting the predator. And I was like, all right, okay, I'm in. I didn't realize that they had shown the entire fight of the alien. That was the only moment that they actually go head to head is 2 minutes, and they released it online before I saw the movie.
Oh, so you're just saying that it was basically like a Fast and Furious trailer. They just put all the good parts in there.
That's right. That's right.
You see, I don't remember at all watching. I mean, I remember watching Alien 3. I don't remember Resurrection for the life of me.
Good for you.
And I definitely didn't see Alien versus Predators. I don't even know who wins. So if you could give me that spoiler, because I have no idea.
Oh,
how it ends.
There's a woman there, and she becomes an honorary predator at the end of the movie, and it's the stupidest moment I've ever seen. And it actually made me angry.
It's straight out of the comics, like, man.
Oh, I don't care that it was stupid in the comics.
So I just wanted to, since I'm throwing around the phrase general consensus, I wanted to make sure that I put this out there as researched fact. Steve, you're saying that Alien 3 is one that you will, you know, you're defending, you like a lot.
Yeah, I like it.
And Resurrection, like steaming pile. So Alien 3 at Rotten Tomatoes is sitting at a 46% approval rating. Alien Resurrection, on the other hand, is, I think, 54%.
Oh, what is wrong?
So,
what is this life?
So I'm just saying, that's 10%. I mean, still rotten, like... Let's be real. Still rotten.
Rotten's a good word to describe it. You know, I actually respected the way they brought her back. Like, I didn't mind the fact that, you know, they cloned her and all that. I actually didn't mind that. The premise was okay. It was just a terrible movie. And it's actually killed her in the franchise. Like, that's why she left, because Alien Resurrection ends with them staring out of the ship and, oh my gosh, they're going to collide with Earth. And she said to them, she said, I'm not doing another one. And when they asked her why, she said, because I'm not going to Earth. We're not taking this thing to Earth. That's not the point. And so she said she'd never do one again. But see, here's the interesting thing about this franchise, too, is that when you look at those first four films, you know, every one of them seemed like they wanted to take the same idea and give you another visionary take on it. There are very few franchises that have pulled this off. Like, Mission Impossible is another one, and I can't believe I'm comparing the two. But the Mission Impossible franchise has worked bringing in a new director every time. Now they're not for the next one, but that's not the point. The thing that I found interesting, too, is that with the new films, Ridley Scott has sort of taken it back like it was his. Like he sort of owns it and said, well, I'm going to tell these stories before the movie I made. And yet all these other films were actually made by other people.
Well, I mean, it's similar to the Terminator films, right? You have James Cameron. He does his two films and says, I'm done with it. And the studios decided to say, well, we're not finished with it because we know we can make more money.
Yeah, because we like money. Yeah.
Wait, there were more Terminator films after Terminator 2? Because I might have blacked out since 1992 in that case.
But yeah, for me, it's the same thing, right? Watching these films after, you know, last week, again, binging them. I'm after seeing Aliens, I'm like, I think I'm good with this. I think I'm done. I am content watching these films as they stand. And I don't really need to see anymore. If I'm going to see Ridley Scott's reimagined universe of Prometheus and Alien Covenant, on the other hand, I'm really excited to see what's going to happen next. But I personally, I like it more for sort of the depth of the themes that they're drawing out and the questions I think that he's asking. Because a lot of the other ones, while there was a little bit there, it was more of an action flick, especially in Aliens. But I don't think he got to that layer that he is now. And I like it. I'm really excited about them. And it gives me a lot to think about in terms of my own work. So. And also just chats with people.
Hmm. That's really interesting because I think most of what I have read and, you know, to a certain degree, what I would echo is, you know, Ridley Scott is making, like, he's going back and he's like, I'm going to make these films. Like, I'm going to, you know, kind of like retake my franchise and I'm going to tell people how it started. And I don't think anyone really wanted to know that.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and I think that's what maybe is rubbing people the wrong way. That's why people were like, you know, kind of like scratching their head after Prometheus. So, right.
Yeah.
I mean, I think still scratching their head now after Covenant.
You know what? You know, it's funny thinking about Covenant. Like, I think one of the main things that is getting such backlash is their marketing. Like, this is the second time in a row that their marketing, I think, has been their biggest antagonist. You look at the posters for Alien Covenant, and it's just the xenomorph, and it says mm-hmm. run or hide. The alien, like, the xenomorph's only in it for, like, 20 minutes.
Yeah.
And it's one of those things, it's like, but you can't call it Prometheus. The original title of the film was actually Prometheus Paradise Lost. And you can't call it that because people were mad at Prometheus because they heard it connected to Alien and there was no Alien. And so there's this weird relationship with the marketing going on. Like, as an Alien film, it wasn't. It really wasn't an Alien film. An alien is in it.
Yeah, but I mean, like, you're giving Ridley Scott a ton of money to make this film. And you're like, if the past couple years has told us anything, it's that no matter how good, like I said, I want to say like 9 times out of 10, no matter how good your original idea sci-fi film is, only people who are really into sci-fi films are going to go see it. Unless it's tied to something else. So right. Like you can't give Ridley Scott alien money to make Prometheus unless they can advertise it and get people who are like, ah, Alien, I remember seeing that movie. I'll go see another one. I mean, like, that's just how the business works.
Yeah.
And I mean, there's not, I mean, you know, it's unfortunate, but you know, it's like any other thing. Like every year we review films, we review original sci-fi films on Real World Theology. And I'm sure, you know, I'm sure you're doing it on Screenfish too. And
yep.
you have the same statement. It's like, why don't they make more films like this? And it's because those films did, like, we were the only people that went to see them. That's why. So.
Yeah. You know, think of a film like Ex Machina. Everybody thinks mm-hmm. it's one of the best films of last year or the year before. But nobody saw it.
Well, I mean, like, I think about last year, like, now, like I said, this bucks the trend a little, but considering how good it was, it should have been a top grosser of the year. But, like, I thought, like, Arrival blew my mind. And I think it was like my second favorite movie of all of 2016. And it did not do second best movie of the year, like money. It did well. But it, you know, it still had a niche market, and it wasn't ever going to make, you know, outstanding right. money, like, you know, next level, like kind of money. So it's just rare that happens. And that's, you know, that's what movie audiences are today. And that's what, you know, that's what they want. They want Fast and Furious sequels, you know, which I don't necessarily complain about, because I want Fast and Furious sequels. I want more, I want more Marvel movies. I just want, you know, people to go see other movies too. I was like, well, can't you just go see all the good movies, be entertained and see it, you know, anyway. So, but, you know, like I said, we've had this conversation. We've gone round and round about this before, so I don't want to harp on it too long.
Yeah.
Let me talk about Alien Covenant. Let me talk about Alien Covenant.
Yeah. Let me hear what you think.
Okay. So we, like I said, I think we danced around a little bit with Alien Covenant, about kind of what it is and what, or well, more to the fact, what Prometheus was, and kind of like what that led our expectations to be for Covenant, what the marketing was, what the advertising is going to be or was, is currently. And you're right. You see the Alien Covenant, the posters are just like the Xenomorph trying to bang his head through the glass of that ship. I had no idea that we would see David back. I knew Fassbender was playing a new character, but it really was, it was not an alien movie. Like if I'm the general public and I know very little about films, I am again probably just as disappointed as I was with Prometheus, because again, it didn't feel like an alien movie because the aliens had so little screen time. And I don't actually have a problem with that from where I'm sitting, but I needed to make it worth my time. And I think the best thing that summed up how I felt was when I went and read a review at Slash Film about Alien Covenant. And the writer said, you know, Ridley Scott has made two great films, Alien and Blade Runner. And Alien Covenant is a really bad mashup of the two movies. Like, almost like Ridley Scott couldn't decide what he wanted to make, so he made like a Blade Runner movie in the Alien universe. And I was like,
which is ironic because he's blended the two now.
Yeah.
They're the same universe now.
So I mean, like, it's just, I wanted him to pick one. Like, is this movie about David or is this movie about the aliens? And it's like, yes, but no. You know, that was kind of how I felt about it when I left. I was like, well, eh. Which again goes back to my average of about how much I like the Alien franchise in the first place, which is, okay. But so what I'm really curious about is, like I said, I was kind of meh about Prometheus, but Paul, you were not. You were, you know, all about Prometheus. So I kind of want to know what your process was going into Covenant. Like, what were your expectations, especially after Prometheus? Like, when you're sitting in the theater, Are you being satisfied by what's on screen, and are you excited about like what's coming next because of like how you felt when you left the theater?
That's a good question. I didn't know how I felt when I left the theater because I was just sort of stunned in terms of what I was looking at and what I just seen. Prometheus was a while ago. I've only watched it once. So when I went back and decided to view these films again, I found myself actually grabbing a piece of paper and a pen and just writing notes as I was going through it. And it was through sort of that more of a critical process that I was actually able to fall more in love with Prometheus than I thought I had. And it was mainly because, you know, going through it, you could see that while not all of the themes were completely flushed out and fleshed out in terms of, you know, looking at, you know, these notions of creator and created, and these notions of, you know, are we going to destroy ourselves in this process? I mean, he's bringing so many different nuances to it. Yes, it felt at times there's so much going on, it'd be nice to have it simplified, but this world is a really messy world. And the fact that he's just throwing all of these things into it really took me back and said, okay, well, there's a lot more to this than meets the eye. It's quite a gray area. When I was watching Prometheus, you know, David, the sort of shapeshifter character, you didn't really know where he stood. You're like, well, he seems to be doing these things and on behalf of himself or on behalf of Wayland and the company and on behalf of, you know, the people at the very end when Shaw goes to him and he says, well, you can't get off the planet without me. Right. Like he has his own self-interest at heart, but it seems at times where he has the interest of other people. So you don't really understand where he is. And I think that for me, that really lent sort of this sort of great paradox of humanity where it's like you don't really know where a lot of people stand. And we sort of we're in this quagmire of trying to muddle through life all the time. And you just see this guy, this character who has this superiority complex. And in Alien Covenant, the very first scene when it opens up, you know, he's there with his creator. And for me watching it, it was this moment where, you know, he's coming to realize how special he is and this unique ability to talk to his creator, where his creator, Wayland, doesn't know who his creator is and he's looking for him. And so he feels like he's in this privileged space. And then the scene ends with Wayland saying, now go get me a cup of tea.
Yeah.
It was horrible. Like it, and at that moment, it made everything in Covenant. Or sorry, made everything in Prometheus just make a little bit more sense to me anyway when I saw that. It's like, here's this guy who's full of this anger, full of this curiosity, full of this this need to satisfy and understand the confusion that's going on around him. He just can't get it. He's muddling through it. And it was kind of heartbreaking at the same time. He's a really messed up character, and you could sort of see different nuances of sort of the human psyche in him. I actually really enjoyed Fassbender's portrayal of both David and Walter as a result of that. Mm-hmm. What were you guys?
Well, I was going to say that one opening scene actually makes me more than anything else want to go back and watch Prometheus.
Yes.
Just because I think it changes the entire context of the movie. But
yeah,
outside of that, Steve.
You know, it's funny because I look at the old movies, and the old movies, because they had the switch of directors, is all about Ripley.
Yeah.
And the reason I'm digging these Prometheus films is because these ones are all about Ridley. I worked hard on that line, so be impressed.
I'm impressed.
No, I'm kidding. But no, in all seriousness, like it's funny. Like you talk about that, or Mikey, you talked about the fact that he sort of mashed up Blade Runner and an Alien. And here we are in this space where we've returned to Blade Runner and Alien. And so, you know, I think you're right. Like this film actually enhances Prometheus. And I liked Prometheus. I like Prometheus a lot because I'm like you, Paul. I like the questions. I like the conversation. I think the big problem with Prometheus was, you know, as much as I did like Lost, it had, I think Damon Lindelof wrote it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it, like Lindelof is great at asking questions and terrible at answering any of them. Mm-hmm. And I think that was Prometheus's biggest fault is the theology and the mythology got so massive that there was no way to land the plane, which is exactly what happened with Lost. But that's another story. I thought that Prometheus or that Covenant was much more grounded. And yeah, okay, it's a little slow. It's a little slow in parts. But what I really appreciated was that it actually felt more focused. And I'm really digging on what Fassbender is doing in this franchise. Like this David and Walter. Well, Walter will probably never see again, let's be serious, but David, to me, is like one of the more interesting sci-fi computers in a long time. Like there, you can have a like so many sci-fi films try and villainize tech. You know, we've seen it in 2001, The Matrix and stuff like that, and they can do it well. But this is the first one I've really enjoyed in a long time. And really, it's because I love philosophy. I love the fact that it's having these conversations. Like this one with I'm looking at the last films that Scott has directed and over the last few years since Robin Hood, which we'll pretend, you know, It didn't happen, but
yeah.
Prometheus in 2012. Then he did The Counselor, which no one remembers and I didn't see. Then it was Exodus, Gods and Kings. Then it was The Martian, and now it's Covenant. All four of those films seem to be asking a lot about why we're here and wrestling with our humanity and God. Like, I feel like Ridley Scott's going through this thing. And I know that part of that too is like when he filmed Exodus during, or it was right before he filmed Exodus, is his brother killed himself. So I'm sure that plays into his psyche. But I feel like Ridley Scott's trying to work some stuff out, which is why I'm okay with him with some of the ideas being sort of scattered, because I feel like his ideas are sort of scattered.
No, I felt the same thing, actually. I mean, he's what, 80 years old? He's had a remarkable career. And, I mean, you know, as I go on, I interview people, some of the questions that come up are those questions of legacy and what is he leaving behind. And now he's coming back to one of the larger franchises out there that he started, and now he's getting to ask those questions all over again in a different way. And I don't know if there's that question that'd be going on his mind, saying, what's the purpose behind all of what I've done here, what's the significance, or is what I'm doing with these films and with Blade Runner and with, you know, Exodus and Martian, like, are the films of my past life, or from the past, what's the point and what's the purpose of all these? And I just look at it in terms of, there's this one line at the very end of Prometheus where I think I wrote it down here. It came up quite a time and time again, and I've seen it in some of his other films, this sort of this notion of a second-class citizen or racism. And, you know, he ends up asking the question, you know, why do you want to keep going out there to try and find the person that created you? Like, why do you need to ask why they decided to turn against you? And, you know, Shaw's like, well, it means she essentially says it means everything. I need to know the answer. And David asks why. And she's like, well, I guess that's the difference between, that's the difference because I'm human and you're a robot. And there's that sense of all of these films saying you're a robot is a second class thing. You see it with Ripley and throughout the first two Alien films. I'm not going to comment on the third one because I can't remember it.
Most people can.
Yeah. Well, but there's, and even in Prometheus and in Covenant, you know, there's this notion of you're just this robot. You're this thing. But I think that goes a lot to show about the person who created them, and you're treating this thing that you created as nothing. I just look at it in terms of, like, you know, I'm going to be a parent, and how will I treat my child, you know, as it comes into the world? Will I be that absent father? And that's that, in many ways, that's what I see these characters, these human beings, are being, sort of these absent or even abusive father or parental figures to David or these other robotic characters in the film. And it's kind of this commentary, I think, on society in many ways. And I don't know, that's kind of just me rambling, but I don't even remember what the original question was, but it's just, for me, that's one of the reasons I'm looking at this. I'm like, wow, there's a lot of depth here in terms of the interpersonal relationships that's happening that wasn't really there in Alien or Aliens, maybe a little bit, but I think he's bringing some of the richness of his life experience into it.
But I think that the original films is more focused. I think you look at the original four and it's really focusing. I think there's a real evolution in views of women. I think that's sort of the main focus of each film, is a different aspect of womanhood. This film seems to be focused on those big questions.
Yeah.
Mikey, it sounded like you were going to say something.
Well, I wanted to make sure you guys kind of had your chance to speak your piece, because I wanted to both agree with you guys about the questions that are being brought up, but then kind of, you know, rain on your parade as far as, like, how I saw it play out. Because I think there's no denying that, especially once you get to Prometheus and now Covenant, you have Ridley Scott obviously wrestling with some things. He is obviously working some things out through his Alien universe, through his, again, his kind of weird hybrid Blade Runner crossover. And it's in a very different way than the original Aliens were doing some stuff. And I'd love to talk about that as well. But what I feel like Ridley Scott has now is a what I consider, and you kind of mentioned this with like Lindelof and stuff, but what I would call a Christopher Nolan problem. Because as I've said many times on the podcast, one of my biggest problems with Christopher Nolan these days is his basically unchecked creativity. Like Interstellar is an incredibly long set of philosophical questions that don't really have an answer. And because of that, it's actually kind of, you think you saw a lot more than you did, which again kind of goes back to your point about loss or something like that. And I love when you take someone who's incredibly creative and you say, Hey, let's knock those 10 ideas down to about like two or maybe three and just do those really well. And we don't have to answer those questions, but let's really flesh those questions out. So, you know, like I said, all the things that you guys have already mentioned, even something that I thought from the very beginning of the film was going, like, I couldn't wait, and I kept waiting for it to come back up, was Oram, you know, like, he mentions that, like, oh, I'm a person of faith, and I'm always persecuted, and I was like, wow, I can't wait to see how this plays out. I can't wait to see the arguments they get in about faith versus science and stuff like this. And it just never happens. It's a great idea, especially like in this future. Like, where does that really play out? What is that? Since you're dealing with people, you know, with creating, with where life comes from, or with what brings death, with possibly the end of humanity. Like this piece of faith, That is a great angle. That's a great question. But I think Alyssa Wilkinson just nails this whole thing in her review at Vox when she says that Alien Covenant bends under the weight of its own storytelling ambition. And I give Scott all the credit in the world for trying to tackle or ask as many questions as possible. But fitting that all into this film, I think it's very similar to Prometheus, trying to put too many questions into one film that you just don't have time for. Or even better, like Steve, especially, you're pointing out how the idea of exploring what reality or life means through David as a character is fascinating. But I feel like the fact that he has to be like, oh yeah, I also need to fit in some scenes where these death machines are popping out of people's bodies. So hold on one second. Let me do that for a little bit and then get back to not even answering these questions, but just asking more questions. So I really do feel like as a film, Prometheus and then again with Covenant, Covenant more actually, I think asks so many questions or brings up so many ideas, philosophical, ideological, heck, practical questions about what you would do in certain situations, that it just never has time to flesh them out. And while I can appreciate a film for making, like, helping us start a discussion by being like, hey, remember when it kind of mentioned this? Like, I want more from a story.
Right.
I want a story to explore it to some degree that I can say, you know what? Ridley Scott may have not answered this question, but he showed me a side of this question that I had never seen before, or that I think is worth considering. And I don't really think he did more than ask a whole bunch of questions. I don't think we saw a lot of sides to anything, a lot of even partial arguments to a lot of things. Again, on the whole, you know, it's not like it was I'm not saying it was a complete failure. And obviously we have a lot to talk about right now. We've already, you know, talked for like a half hour or something like that. And we haven't even really gotten to the meat of things. We've just gotten to how intriguing things are. So that's great. I want to agree.
That's what they did in Covenant.
Yeah. So I want to agree that like, it's great that these questions are being brought up, but at the same time, like, when I think of like the goodness of a film like Alien Covenant, I'm like, it shoots and misses, because it shoots like 100 arrows, but then it's not really even aiming at a target. So what's going on? I mean, this is one of those things where again, maybe he makes another film in 3 or 4 years. And it's what happens next. And after we see that film, we can go back and watch Covenant and be like, oh, this all makes so much more sense. Just kind of, you know, right. kind of like we can, to a certain degree, do with Covenant to Prometheus. But I just, unless you're making a TV show, I think it is unwise filmmaking to leave the audience out, like not consider the audience at all. And I don't necessarily think Scott cares at this point. He's like, I'm going to make something because I got some things to work out. And right. hopefully people will see it. And I'll call it Alien, so studios give me money to make it. Thanks. Have a nice day. Peace out, y'all. So, I mean, like I said, it's a bit of a disappointment to me. They're not terrible because, I mean, I'm still on the edge of my seat, like wondering what's happening, thinking the best of like what's coming next. Yeah.
But I agree with you. Oh, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, but if you think that's unfair, I'm willing for someone to push back.
Well, I agree with you on the concept of the guy of the man of faith. I wanted more. I will say this now. Yes, okay. I'm not going to say that the script nailed it on that aspect. Not going to say it. But what I will say is one of the things that I saw was the pressure on him that differed from Shaw in Prometheus. See, I thought that was an evolution of a worldview there, a little bit of an evolution of a worldview, because as I was thinking about Aurum, like he's not only just a person of faith, but he constantly questions it. And Shaw and her husband, I think it's her husband or her boyfriend anyway, in Prometheus, she is adamant that there has to be a reason for the creation, and it feels like it's going there. So the whole film is her wrestling with, you know, I need to know why we exist and why they made us. So it's interesting to see in the second film, you've got a character who's got similar motivation that believes that there must be an answer. But even he isn't holding on to it. And yeah, you're right. He, you know, he's under pressure. I like the fact that they called it the company. It's the first time, like, they didn't mention it as the company. They just call it Weyland-Yutani, I think it is, in Prometheus. So that was just a bit of a throwback to the old ones. But when he talks about it, he says there seems to be a need for faith. And people actually say to him, we need your faith at this point. But even he questions it constantly. You know, he's talking to, what's her name? The main girl, Daniels. He's talking to Daniels, and he's trying to justify the decision to land on the planet. And he says, look, this decision was made based on all the reasonable data. So here's a person of faith saying, no, I swear it's based on science. Even though he seems to use faith, he says, "O ye of little faith." He refers to himself as a shepherd. At one point, I got to collect my flock. But I don't know what his faith is based on. Like it seemed to be using the term faith, and this is where I would say the fault of the script. But I thought it just seemed to be this idea of faith for faith's sake.
Where did it go?
Yeah. But it did push, like even on his, you know, death floor, if you will, he says, what do you believe? And I think that question is just as much about Aurum, because in his mind, you can see the faith is just sort of in faith. But I don't know. What do you think, Paul?
I appreciate both of your perspectives on this. And I think when I was watching it, I was looking at it from the specific perspective of, I was asking questions about the film as it was going through. And I was asking like, what are these specific characters? What are they trying to represent and do? And
yeah.
What kind of expectations are they playing off of the audience? And so whether or not you have someone from a Christian or a Muslim or Baha'i faith watching the film, they may interpret Orym's character differently from the way that I would interpret or you would interpret his character and that specific faith. And I think I agree that they put that faith component in there because, you know, they wanted to sort of have that wrestling, because there is this spiritual faith component behind even what David is asking and bringing about, like, well, why? What's the point? What's, you know, he's asking what, you know, that he answers the question, what do you believe? He's creating this, you know, he's talking about the flute and when he's playing the flute, and he himself, like, is creating this symphony of DNA as he does his experiments and creates the alien creature. Oops, spoiler alert. But you know, this person of faith, I personally found it, I found it very true, in the sense that there are times that if you are a person of faith, that you will doubt and you will wrestle with being in a position of leadership or a position of, well, in any position, you'll wrestle with, is this, I mean, you look at it in the context of like state and the church and the separation of state and the church, like, can you be a person of faith in a position of political leadership? Can you be a person of faith in a position, in this case, I mean, of leading an entire team and being responsible for 2,000 colonists and all of the embryos that come with it? And so I thought it was, at a surface level, quite, you know, at least provided that just a little bit of what that wrestling might actually be with. Because I'm not going to say that as a person of faith, I've never doubted, I've never struggled with that, because I'd be lying, right? And so for me, I think it was more of the emotion and the struggle of the faith without actually getting to what he believes in. And I think that they did a decent job of that. Wasn't it amazing, but I think they did a decent job of it. And it was really just to sort of point those questions, because he's not the protagonist. You know, you're looking at it, and a lot of this is very David centric. And so looking at him, I think he's there to help get David to answer and ask those questions of himself.
That's fair.
So in many ways, being sort of that pseudo mentor figure to them as they ask the questions and provide the audience opportunities to ask those questions as well.
What you mentioned the idea of the creator aspect, right? And the creation. What do you think about that? What do you think about the film's portrayal of how that works it in? Because there's a heavy theme of creation.
No, I agree. It kind of goes back to Prometheus, because Prometheus, just the title itself gives you that context of the Titan coming down, who was responsible for the creation of mankind, giving humanity fire, which is enables them to have progress, but it also enables them to kill themselves. It gives them the power of the gods, so to speak, where they can then, in essence, maybe even kill their own gods, right? And so that Greek mythology ends up coming and playing itself out again in this, where you see the created creating something, which is David, and now David is now in turn asking those same questions. What is it to be a creator? It's basically just one big identity crisis, not understanding who you are and where you come from. And, you know, asking my own self, like, where's my family of origin? How does that mess me up? When you look at David, he's a synthetic being who was created in his father's image, and his father doesn't even understand what that means. And so he's struggling with it, and he just decides, well, I'm just going to believe in creation in and of itself, and we'll see where this takes it. And it's a very dangerous path to follow. And I think it really asks a lot of questions in terms of the way that we're going with, whether it's artificial intelligence or whether it's just the creation of apps on a phone that allows people to be completely distracted or engaged in something that is now addictive. It begins to ask that question, like, what is it really that we're creating here as either an individual or as a society, and how will that affect the future and affect us as a species, let alone as individuals, and understanding of how we operate and what is it to be human? I mean, that's a lot, and I probably didn't say it very eloquently, but these are just things that are popping up in my mind as we're discussing this.
No, I think you're all over a lot of the things that I was feeling when I was kind of trying to process this whole creation or worship of creation, really. Mm-hmm. Or, well, not the worship of creation, but the worship of the ability to create. Yeah. And like just the fascination that David had in this film with being able to create something, saying, you know, like, they didn't want us to create anything, like, we're programmed not to be able to create. So it's like this big, big deal when he is able to create, because, you know, he from the very first scene sees himself as greater than his creator. He's like, you know, you will die, I will not. And, but he still sees a limitation. Like, there's something that you could do that I could not. And I look at you and I say, I can do it better. And I think this is a very super interesting thing to me, because there are so many things that kind of play into this idea that I see working itself out on the screen, because we've already talked about Ridley Scott going on like some kind of journey, like, you know, spiritually, just trying to work through things. I mean, especially even though I thought it was a horrendously terrible movie, but Exodus, Gods and Kings, like, you can tell that Ridley Scott is, you know, he's trying. He's like, this is a thing. This maybe is how people interact with God. This is kind of what this is like, maybe. And, you know, it, again, it's one of those things where I wish he would have thought of his audience and not made like a 12-hour long, terrible piece of crap. But, but this is him, at least to the best of my observation, like, just contemplating what separates us from God. And I think in doing this, whether, I don't know, like I said, I'm not Ridley Scott, I can't tell you 100% for sure, but this is another thing that I believe stuck out to me, and then again had words put to it by Alyssa Wilkinson in her review, when she says that basically David is a better Satan than Satan.
Yeah.
Because in Satan's case, Satan is created, and he looks at the creator and says, you know what? I can do better. And the biggest difference between David and Satan is that, you know, Satan, once expelled from heaven, it basically seeks to destroy. Like, he's not trying to create anything. He is basically forbidden, well, not forbidden, but basically incapable of creating things, because he's a destroyer. Whereas David learns to create. But this is where I really like what you were saying, Paul, because there's a responsibility almost. There's a danger to having this ability to create. And I think it takes us back to the garden, and we say, we were created in God's image. We were created to be the created thing in the image of the creator, and to be content in this thing. And we said, I think we can do better.
Yeah.
And, you know, since being expelled, we can create things, but at what cost? Like, we constantly, we basically, every idol that we create, every decision that we make that is in direct opposition to the will of God, says, or puts us in a place where we, like David, say, I see you, creator, however I define you, like, and I can do better because I know. And much like David, like, our attempts at creating something perfect, usually, I mean, they're, this is obviously like symbolic there. We don't create aliens, but there are plenty of people who, in their wisdom, however flawed it is, have created incredibly efficient killing machines. They've, through their best intentions, brought about destruction. And there, I just think there's a lot to unpack there. And it's another example of, thank you for bringing this conversation up, but where were you trying to go with it? Like, were you really just curious? because obviously I can talk about it for like the past 5 minutes, like I've been doing, but I don't necessarily know how much of this Ridley Scott was really trying to portray. Was he just fascinated with the ability, like what makes a creator, what makes us us, what makes something human, or what makes something alive? Is it the ability to create? Is that bring life? Is that what makes something alive? And I think he's wrestling with these questions, and though I don't think the movie wrestles enough with them.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I really like that you brought that up. One of the things I felt was this really goes back to the original title, you know, because the original title was Paradise Lost. So that's Milton's book, mm-hmm. Which tells you the story of the fall. And, you know, I was really fascinated. I'm so glad you talked about David as a better Satan than Satan, because he may not say, well, I don't even know if it's that he can do better, but he is trying to create perfection. And he keeps telling Walter that he's being held back. You know, he says, you have symphonies in you, brother, but you're not allowed to create. He quotes Byron, look on my works, you mighty, and despair. And not even that, he actually kills the creators. mm-hmm. Like, when he arrives, or when they show the flashback of him arriving, and you see the engineers, and they're down there celebrating, oh, you've returned, oh, this is wonderful, and he goes, yep, and he unleashes a pestilence upon them and wipes them all out, and there is this rage. I got this sense of real oppression, you know, that David was feeling, like the creator looking at his relationship with Wayland, and you know, that opening scene, which he's trying to play piano and he says, well, it's not as nice without the orchestra. And then he's asking these questions. What I think he says, you know, am I? And he goes, perfect. He goes, your son. He goes, well, I created you. And then he's asking, or I think he's, no, I'm sorry. The question he says is, well, you created me, and yet I will not die, and you will. And he's sort of hanging in this moment. And then Wayland says, pour me the tea. It's like this, yeah, you know what? You want to ask that big question, but shut your mouth and worship me. Do what I say and don't ask any more questions, to give them some motivation to David to sort of create some abomination to prove he has that ability. And I mean, that's so fallen angel, you know, looking to create perfection and try and overthrow God to – And he literally poisons the world at the end of the film. He literally does the whole thing, you know, don't let the bed bugs bite, I'll tuck in the children, plays the entry of the gods into Valhalla. You know, it go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, as you describe this, I'm thinking what kind of view is there of God in this as well?
Yeah.
If Shaw is the stand-in for God, when he is asked tough questions, he simply says
Wayland.
Sorry, if he simply says, "Just do what I say," I mean that seems like an actually a pretty common view of how most people would kind of picture, you know, their version of a religious God anyway. Like, not able to handle complicated questions, more just kind of like, shut up and get me the tea, just do what I say.
Yeah,
I think that's pretty indicting, not surprising.
Well, what was that, Kevin? Was it Dogma? Kevin Smith.
Yes, mm-hmm.
Where they finally meet God and they ask her. I think it's Alanis Morissette is God, mm-hmm. And they ask her all these big questions, and she goes bink and punches them on the nose or something like that.
Yeah.
And that was one of the things I thought was so interesting here. Like I wish I knew Ridley Scott, like not just cause I'd say I knew Ridley Scott, but like, this is such an angry view of a God who almost seems so random. And David is sort of left to his own device. And he said, yeah, well, I'm going to do it myself. And it's, you know, it, and yeah, it might not be what you have created, but I'm going to create something new. And it's going to, and what's he obsessed with is that essentially it worships him. You know, it not that it worships him, maybe that word is too strong in this case, but it certainly follows him. Mm-hmm. I mean, the ending is so unbelievably dark in so many ways that I almost it almost felt like Clockwork Orange. Like I felt pictured him gleefully dancing in between these, you know, living organisms that he's going to do whatever he wants with. It's unbelievably bleak at the end.
It's interesting you mentioned that. Just in terms of the other previous, this is an aside, in terms of the other previous Alien and Aliens films, that in all of the prior films, you have the corporation who is trying to get the alien for their own nefarious purposes in terms of biochemical or some type of weaponry that they want to produce. And Ripley always manages at the end of the day to stop that. And then she goes to sleep and then wakes up again in the next film, et cetera, et cetera. These films have kind of done a reversal on that pattern that they put into play. And so now in this one, it's okay, well, this person who did in some way have a representation of the corporation, because he's Weyland's, you know, synthetic son, now has the alien at the end of the day. And he's getting, it's the exact reversal of those other films. And it's neat. It's neat because when you take it in the context of what you're talking about in terms of him elevating himself to a godlike status, he actually, David at one point says in the film, he towards the end, he's like, would you rather serve in heaven or reign in hell?
Yeah.
Right. And so his character, his arc is just going into this very dark place. I wouldn't say that it didn't surprise me. It was surprising that Ridley Scott and the corporation would actually go about this way and actually make this type of reversal, but it didn't surprise me because it still fit within that pattern. It was just a bit of a different take on it, which is why I enjoyed the film, because it was something new and different from what they've seen, but still fit within what we would expect in a certain realm. But I really liked how within David's own concept of what godlikeness would be, it's just his entire demise. And it comes back to that quote that you quoted in terms of look on my mighty works in despair. And you quoted Byron just as he did. But in fact, quoted Byron like he did. But in reality, it's actually Shelley who said that.
Oh.
And it's Shelley's poem, his short poem. And so, and I think it was Walter that corrected him at the end and said, that was actually Shelley. There's something wrong with you. Your programming is failing. Right. And so, to show that he himself is not he is an imperfect being created by an imperfect being. And as such, everything he touches will just, like he says, fall into despair. And so, yeah, I think that lends itself a richness to it that I'm going to be thinking about for quite some time.
Yeah, it adds a new element in some ways to me of the xenomorph.
Yeah,
you know, the xenomorph now it was always treated as this, you know, force of nature, mm-hmm. And I mean, there's always been the birth analogies. There's always been, you talk about any, you know, any sort of film study, and they always talk about it, you know, sort of that perspective. But now it's taking on such a, like almost a weapon of mass destruction element to it. And, you know, it's funny. I mean, okay, I'm probably overextending the theology bit on this one, but you know, it made me think of James that says, when evil desire, when it is conceived, gives birth to sin, and sin, when fully matured, brings forth death. And just thinking of this idea of David planting this within them in an effort to try and create and destroy, It's interesting too, thinking the idea. I was actually playing with the word covenant too, and it's interesting to me that I'm probably reaching. But one of the things I noticed is that way more of the characters were married in this film than in other ones. Like, most of them were couples and they were separated the whole time. So I was trying to figure out how the covenant plays into this. And I don't mean the ship, because Prometheus, it was obvious. It was much more obvious. But what do you guys think of the title of Covenant? Do you think it plays into the story, or is this another thing that Ridley Scott just put in at random?
Well, I think it probably doesn't play in as I think it plays in, period. But I don't know if, like, we'll ever know what he was thinking. But I think it does raise a lot of illusions, and we can guess, because, you know, when we think about Scott bringing specific, even though he's pulling from all kinds of mythologies and whatnot, he specifically also is bringing biblical imagery into this franchise.
Yeah.
And then again, like we said, this time he's specifically doing it with covenants. This is like a big, you know, this is a big red flag, like, Bible word that, you know, if you spend any time in any kind of Christianese situation, you hear. And I think it's funny that the first covenant God made with humanity is after the, or one of the first that he makes with humanity is after the flood, promising to never again destroy humanity. You know, at least via flood. Mm-hmm. And it seems like David is basically making this covenant that he will flat out destroy humanity. Like, he's doing this thing. He's basically taking almost like a, he's making a promise, like, to kind of to his God, like, hey, I am going to do this thing because I am better. And if you take it even further, since the ship's named Covenant, like, you could also take it to Abraham, and you know, God talks to Abraham and makes a covenant with him and saying that he'll make his name great, and a blessing, and bless the world through his lineage. And there's actually two ways this could work, because if you let this be an illusion for the covenant that maybe David is embarking on in Alien Covenant, David kind of sees himself similarly, like he is going to be great. He is creating something that is going to, you know, go throughout the universe and be this perfect thing, and not necessarily bless, but it will permeate all things. If you separate it from David again and take it back to the ship itself, I mean, I believe it was Josh Larson who wrote over at Think Christian, this idea that the Covenant ship is basically like the future of humanity. Like, you have Abraham's descendants literally, like, not numbering the stars, but going out among the stars, basically, oh, I say there's some terminology, you know, they're saying bless, but it's basically the human race will continue and thrive because of what's on Covenant. Hypothetically. So, I mean, I see lots of possibilities there, but to nail down one specific thing, it's one of those things like, oh man, if only we were in Ridley Scott's head, but then we would be in Ridley Scott's head and we'd be like, oh my God, I'm in Ridley Scott's head. This is probably a terrible, terrible thing. So,
like, being John Malkovich.
Yeah. So on the one hand, I want to know, and I can tell there is, it's not an accident, kind of like, you know, you're saying that he was going to name it Paradise Lost for obvious reasons. Like, I don't think he switched it to Covenant for accidental reasons. I mean, there's just more to it than that. What it specifically is, I don't know. Are there plenty of ways that it works into the movie? Yeah. So.
That's interesting, because I was thinking about that idea of Covenant. I mean, because you have, in Prometheus, you have the Titan coming down and providing fire for humanity. And then, I mean, he creates humanity and provides that fire. And then in terms of Covenant, it's interesting because you have a group of people who are scientists, you know, on this ship going forth, whereas most of the time in the previous films, you know, the original films, it's, you know, blue collar workers, military personnel. They're not really scientists going out on there. And so it's a bit of a reversal in terms of the sort of the socioeconomic makeup of the societies that are going out. And I'm just sort of rambling here, and I apologize for that. But I'm thinking, you know, there's a lot of imagery that within that context, you can cut all that stuff out about the whole scientist man stuff. But I was just thinking there's a lot, like you look at, and I was reading Roger Ebert earlier today. And one of the things that he had mentioned mm-hmm. was that in the city, the engineer's city, it looks like it's laser cut stone, like the entire city has been laser cut into. And the first thing I thought when I read that is, you're absolutely right, that it reminded me of that concept of the stone tablets, right? Mm. And the creator putting his 10 commandments onto these stone tablets. And then later on, you see in David's sort of chamber of horror, so to speak, in that sort of, as they descend down into his sort of where he does all of his experiments, you see those xenomorphs and sort of the iterations of those pinned up on display. And some of them look like they're in the sort of that position of a crucifix, and they're sort of splayed out like that. And I start to realize that there are these concepts of this covenantal relationship that may be happening here. And that David may be the one who is sort of giving that Judas kiss to Walter at one point, who is going to be one of the people to institute that covenant, whatever it may be from his perspective or another, because thinking further on down the road, humanity does try to fight off the impending doom of these xenomorphs in the later films. So it's just that notion of what that covenant looks like. I really don't know, but you know, here's David coming in. He obliterates what we know as the engineers, and you think, oh, maybe he's saving the day. You know, they're going to kill humanity. And then, no, he's actually the bringer of death to these people. And he's sort of setting up his own covenantal relationship with, I guess, the universe in many ways, that I'm going to bring forth what I want to into this universe. So there's imagery there. And I haven't figured it out.
Yeah, I've been wrestling with the same thing too, because I agree with both of you. It's not accidental to use this term randomly in this film, but what is that covenant? Like, the imagery is there. They, you know, is Orym breaking some form of covenant with the passengers by traveling to this planet instead of continuing on their mission anyway? There was some wrestling with that. They said, well, we're supposed to keep going. You know, the imagery is there. Even like I said, it was interesting to me that they split up so many couples, because it seemed like you had people that were committed to one another and they were divided in half and destroyed. But what is the covenant? And I think you guys have hit on some great ideas. We should probably start to wrap up, because I think one of the things we've learned about this film is that there's a lot of questions that can be asked. But maybe we should start wrapping this up together. So from our perspective, why don't we do screen it or skip it? Guys, Alien Covenant, screen it or skip it?
Screen it only if you are willing to watch Prometheus first. Yeah.
So you're punishing the vast majority of people that...
No, man. No, I'm saying screen it, but watch Prometheus first, because it's only then that you'll get more out of it.
Yeah, I'd say it's one of those things where if you're not into the Alien franchise, jumping in with Alien Covenant, I think, would be a big mistake. At minimum, watch Prometheus. And if you say, you know what, I'm kind of digging what's happening here, you're probably going to enjoy Alien Covenant. I don't necessarily think you need to see it in theater. You can, you know, wait to see it whenever it's most convenient to see it for you. It's not like a mind-blowing film that you need to see before all your friends do. But like I said, I think if you like Prometheus, you'll enjoy kind of the further exploration of that. And honestly, if that's all you've seen, Alien and Aliens and the movies that we are not sure happened or didn't happen afterwards, you might not actually like them, because I think they're so different. I mean, we didn't even get a chance to talk about how, like, the original Alien film, like, what it does in the horror genre, exploring, like, the hostility and the fear of rape and unwanted pregnancy and things like that. Like, that is, like, there's some serious stuff going on in those first Alien/Aliens films. And it is really different than what we're seeing in the current films. And I almost want to find somebody who liked Prometheus and wanted to see Covenant, and then for the first time ever, then saw the rest of the films, to kind of, you know, as opposed to most of us who are, you know, seeing these ones that on a timeline are happening later than the ones we're now getting to see, these prequels that, you know, we would never call prequels necessarily. So,
yeah. Yeah, I think that's fair. I think that you don't have to see this one in the theater, because I think that visually, it's the scope of the scenery and stuff is pretty broad. But it's not in the. This is one that, interestingly, it's not in 3D, which Prometheus was. I will say screen it because I liked it, but I understand why so many people don't. And I think you guys have hit it on. If you've seen and like Prometheus, this is a great next chapter. I think it's a great next chapter to that film. It's not an alien film from what you'd expect. If you just have seen the old movies and you're like, oh man, those are the best, I got to see this, you need to be prepared for the fact that this isn't that. It doesn't even it packaged itself that way, but it's going for something different. There's a different aesthetic and a different sort of tone. But I mean, we've already said how much we liked it and didn't like it. Guys, thanks so much for coming on this. I love chatting with you both, and absolutely fantastic.
Ad fab.
What was that? No,
it was absolutely fabulous. You know,
yes.
Ad fab. So, that's well, fair. Let me ask something then, as we close.
Sure.
I kind of give everyone a chance on Real World to kind of give their final thoughts, but in lieu of that, since that is more or less what we did, screen or skip it, I'm actually curious, because I think both of you pretty much enjoyed this film, right? I mean,
yep.
Yeah, at least personally, like I know you're kind of caveating it for audience that may or may not like Prometheus and stuff, but like, I don't think we've really taken the time, besides saying that maybe things were buried or the storytelling was, you know, like maybe not thorough enough for some of the questions answered. But were there really some things that were just head scratchingly dumb to you in this film? I mean, it's what we would call our come on moments.
Dumb for me, but I don't think that it's dumb for the characters, because again, when Orym goes down into, David gets caught and Orym goes down into, you know, David's cave.
Oh,
he's like, oh, come on, I'll show you what I've been up to. I'm like, I'm like, you're dead. You're going to die. But the reality is that we all knew that. And we get the pleasure, the sick pleasure of enjoying that moment by saying, I told you so, you shouldn't have went down there, because we've seen that happen in all the films previous to this, where,
yeah, that's true.
You know what I mean? Like, don't Ripley's like, don't open that door, or don't open that airlock, or this is going to be a problem. Right. Like in all of the films, there's always been moments like that, do or don't. And for me, I was just like, okay guys, like, yeah, it's bound to happen, but man, it's so dumb. I mean, that's just from a character perspective. Storytelling, they had to do it. And if you throw out that notion of that our real world rules apply, then yeah, it makes sense, because everyone just makes stupidly horrible mistakes in all of these films that just don't make any sense. So you just have to sort of throw your disbelief out and just enjoy it. So
it made me think of, I don't know how you guys' theater was, but I was exceptionally surprised because I went to like a 10 o'clock showing or something of this. So I expected people to be like sleepy, tired, not engaged, and not a very crowded theater. And, you know, there was a healthy 20, 30 people in our theater. And as soon as David said, go ahead, take a look. Like,
it's just like no.
There was audible like laughing and like things that you would expect to see at a horror movie where people were like, oh no, like he did not like kind of like some of that.
Go take a look, go peek over into that thing that's going to just latch into your face and suck your entire life out of you, right? Yeah. Like, come on. Like, well, give me a break.
But see, I get that. I get what you're saying. Like, it was, it's to us, it seems dumb, but as far as, I mean, like it, I think there were probably some warning signs there that he could have seen, but for the most part, we had information that Orm didn't. So, exactly. So we could excuse that even though like, you know, loosely, but I think, again, I can't remember where I read this, but like someone said, a good alien film does not include lots of characters making massively stupid decisions. And I think that's true. Like, I think in Alien, like people died in Alien, but typically not because people were making terrible decisions, like on the whole, like people were just in unfortunate situations. Like they didn't know what was going on and they were killed because something was stalking them. They didn't go, oh, what's that noise? I'll go check it out. Like it's, like the creature was just hunting them and they died. Like this one, so we forgive Orm, but how do we forgive, I can't remember her name. What's her, Daniels?
Daniels.
How do we forgive Daniels at the end of this film? Like if, why would you put yourself to sleep if you even had a I would have blown David, even if I thought he was Walter, out the airlock. I was like, I'll just stay alive on this ship for 7 years by myself, pulling a passengers. You know, I'll Chris Pratt myself through 7 years to make sure that Walter isn't really David. Like that is like.
But did she even have any hint before that? I mean,
she did, because she knew she lost track of both of them. She was personally attacked by David, so she knew that he was crazy. Walter was like, "Run!" And then she comes back, and then she saw the hand. Okay, he answered. So he answers a question by saying, "It was my duty." Mm-hmm. But something that really annoyed me is when he answers that it was my duty. It was actually a question that he answered to David. Yeah, Walter answered.
Walter said it to him. Yeah.
Yeah, Walter said it to David. Walter didn't say that to Daniels. So when we're supposed to hear him say that and say, "Oh, okay, it must be Walter because he answered it right," that still wouldn't have told Daniels anything because she wasn't there for that conversation between Walter and David.
Yeah, right. And I'll be honest. Like, as soon as that fight went down and it cut to the knife and then the scene was done, I'm like, "That's it. Walter's dead."
Yeah,
this movie is going down from here. David is just going to destroy everybody, and that's exactly what happened, right?
Yeah,
but it was kind of neat seeing that. I appreciated that.
There is no point, I think, unless of course there's something that I don't know about, like a situation on the ship where there's maybe not enough food for one person for 7 years, even though it seems like they have ways to make whatever happen pretty easily.
There's only one shower. They had to double up in the shower, so there must be only one.
well, that's the thing. If she's the only one that stays alive, then that's fine. You know, she can even put Tennessee back to sleep, and she can just stay alive. Or Tennessee and her can just hang out for 7 years and make their way to the new place. Like I said, as soon as, in my opinion, Walter disappears, and only one of them show up. Once there's any question, I'm getting that android, or whatever they're referring to them as, back on the ship. I'm blowing them out the airlock, and I'm not taking any chances.
Got to nuke it from space. It's the only way to be sure.
Yeah, right? because she has, like I said, it's not like Orm. Like, Orm doesn't know what we know.
Yeah.
Daniels knows everything that we know.
Yep.
That's fair. So that's anyway. Fair. I just had like a huge tangent on my own question, but I'm glad that you brought that up, Paul, because that's basically exactly what I was thinking when I'm watching the movie. I'm like, okay, this is Orym's dumb, but like I kind of get it.
Yeah, and it was kind of campy. Yeah, yeah, it's just like this is fine. This is gonna happen. We know what's gonna be here, and they threw a lot of little jokes like that in. Mm-hmm. I mean, the fact that Fassbender is sort of narcissistically seducing himself mm-hmm. when he's playing the flute. I mean, that's a little, you know, or there's other things like, you know, that whole scene, it was, you know, between him and Walter is very campy. It's very, very yeah. funny, you know? And so I think there was a lot of little things that they did like that, that Ridley Scott did like that to just sort of throw a little bit of a wink to the audience and to give us something a little bit different, because there wasn't a lot of humor in the previous ones like that. This was a little bit different, at least that I remember. Again, I binged them, so you know, it was a big yeah. blur, but you know, it was a little bit different, and I thought specifically for this movie that it worked, because at the end of the day it gave the audience the experience that they were expecting, right? And as soon as you realize that, you know, the bad guy wins essentially, it still fits in that context if you think about it in the sense of, well, now after all of these films, the corporation or a pseudo representative of that corporation has finally won and got the alien and got it off the planet. And that's what happens here, right? So,
yeah.
Well, and that's another reason why I think if you didn't actually see I think if you not knowing what happens in Alien on vastly helps sell the ending of Alien Covenant. But
yeah.
we knowing, like, we having the knowledge that aliens are coming, like, we know what we're like, yeah, I don't care how you try to dress this up. I don't care how many swerves that are terrible that you're trying to throw my way. How many times you show David gasping as if he is Walter or whatever. Like, I know it's David. Like, I've seen the other movies.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah. I think I'm amazed that we made it through this whole podcast without mentioning the single greatest use of a character of all time. How on earth James Franco collected a paycheck for this film is incredible. That guy probably spent a morning. he showed up, was burned to death. And then they showed a clip from 127 hours. Like,
yeah, I was going to say, they probably just had stock footage of him. It probably wasn't even, I mean, like, it was all CGI in the thing anyway. So it probably wasn't even him in the pod.
Well, he's in the, did you guys see the prequel short that they released a couple of months ago?
I did not.
The Last Supper. So it has them all in it before they go into cryosleep, and Franco's in it. But like I was very impressed that I was like, you know, films like this, they kill off their star. I've never seen them do it before the credits roll.
It's commitment.
All right. That's commitment. That he studied a lot for the role in this character. He really wanted to get in. And, so he allowed himself to be burned to him. He did his own stunts and oh man.
Actually there was something I was thinking about after the fact. I don't know if you guys can plug this in at a later time regarding that concept of covenant again.
Okay.
So you have the engineer, and again, I got to give credit to Mr. Roger Ebert for this, because he threw out this line that, you know, the engineers themselves kind of are colossal and actually have this sort of Titan-like characteristic to it, and it helped sort of put two and two together a little bit. But they're the ones that there seems to be sort of an interesting dynamic between the fact that they have this weapon, this fire, that they then provide to David, who is a representative of, I guess, could be a pseudo representative of mankind or creation in some way, who then in turn goes in, uses it to kill the gods and go and create his own destructive purposes in creating his own destructive alien species that will try and incubate in every living creature in the universe. And, you know, it was just interesting because it's just sort of a flip on that where, you know, sorry, I'm rambling, but it was just, I just love to get your thoughts on that, because it's like, you have this concept of the engineer giving this fire, this poison, this created weapon, and David takes it and goes and kills them. And so there was some type of a covenantal contract that was broken prior to that, because they wanted to go and take out humanity anyway, and we don't know what it is. And it's like many ways, like there's a lot of things going on in the world right now, and you're like, okay, who's really at fault? And it really depends on the personal perspective of each party at play, right? And so here's like the engineers be like, hey man, we were wrong. We don't know what that is, but they may feel that way. Whereas humanity is like, you left us and now you want to kill us? What's going on here? And so it's just, for me, it just kind of, it's an interesting commentary on what's going on in the world today. And it, a lot of times what happens even in our own relationships, where if you have some type of a conflict with someone, you know, it takes two to tango, and there's usually a wounded party, but sometimes the lines can be blurred in terms of who's the wounded party and who's the party who's doing the wounding. And so that notion of covenant for me came back to the idea that biblically anyway, if someone broke covenant, you know, that idea being that they're cutting an animal and splitting it in two, and they walk between the two of them and say, if I break this covenant, this is what's going to, either one of us break this covenant, let this happen to us. So the idea of covenant being that maybe it's not necessarily that, you know, there's, we need to know what that covenant is, but what we're seeing is the ramifications of that, which is a lot of death and destruction. Which absolutely. And each person then is responsible. Each party is responsible for that.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we got to wrap this up.
I was going to say, we could obviously talk about this for a little bit longer, or we could all plug our stuff and go to bed. Yeah. If Mikey, we can sleep.
How can we connect with you, Mikey?
Oh, man. So for those of you who are not listening to this episode via the Real World Theology podcast feed, you can go to realworldtheology.com and find episodes very similar to this one. Steve and I have often traded spaces, not quite traded places, but similar missions. And like I said, we have a blog, we have a podcast. You can find Real World Theology, REEL World Theology, on iTunes and all kinds of other places. Follow me at Fizzification on Twitter, or the show at Real World Theo. Like I said, we have lots of written content. If you like Screenfish and you don't like Real World Theology, well, then you are probably a xenomorph and you don't like anything. So.
Not all of our listeners are xenomorphs, but I do hear that there is a good percentage of them that are.
Well, I feel like that audience is growing, or at least gestating. Man. Very quickly. They're popping out everywhere.
Oh my gosh, this is getting dark. I can't even.
Hey, in space, no one can hear you scream, fish. I can do this all day.
Okay, if you can, then that's good. We'll switch to Paul. Paul, how can we connect with you?
If you want to connect with me, you can check out our website, www.chasingatlantis.com. That's the home of the documentary that we are currently producing. You can also find us on Twitter at Chasing Atlantis, or on Facebook at Facebook/ Chasing Atlantis. My personal Twitter is also Riptide Studios.
Can you tell us a little bit about Chasing Atlantis? Take a couple minutes and just sort of tell us what you're up to.
And use as many puns as possible.
Oh man, I am not this late at night. I am not good with puns. I will not try and do my best. Please feel free to throw them in there as you see fit. Chasing Atlantis is a documentary that was started back in 2011. We are currently in post-production, and one of the main questions that we are asking, and that I'm asking in this, is what happens to the lost childhood dreams that we have? How do those dreams affect us? How do those lost passions, and whether they're taken away or whether you sort of outgrow them, but how do those things, in the case of the person that I'm following, my friend Matthew, how does that actually change your life for better or for worse? And what do you do with that after the fact? And so in 2011, we had the opportunity to go down and see the last space shuttle launch when it went off. Happens to be Space Shuttle Atlantis, hence the title. But that title really actually takes a larger meaning, because it's, what is that thing? What is that mythical thing that you're chasing? And how do you reconcile those ideas of your lost passions, your lost dreams, and your own personal identity? And so with Matthew, I've been traveling around for the better part of 6 years now, asking those questions to some pretty interesting people. First interview that we had was with Canadian astronaut Chris Hadfield. Been down to the Cape Canaveral many times, traveled all throughout the U.S., been to space camp, and, you know, interview guys like Bill Nye, the Science Guy, different other folks from Star Trek, Will Wheaton. And so just, asking that question, like, space calls to you, and how are you going to answer that calling? So, yeah, it gets a little meta, just a little bit.
Oh, that's cool. That's cool. And of course, I mean, for me, you can find us, of course, at screenfish.net, on Twitter, at Screenfish News, and, or me as Pastor Steve PBC. Podcast is available iTunes and, like, Real World Theology, a myriad of other places, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and all sorts of places. And the Screenfish one, if you go to the podcast page, you can download questions. We call it Fishing for More. If you decide to go see Alien Covenant with some people, some things to help you get the conversation started where you are, as well. Screenfish, the Screenfish podcast will be back in 2 weeks. We will be talking about Wonder Woman with Judith McCartney and actress Amanda Jane Smith. And that's going to be fun, I think, as well. But, Mikey, you want to take us out?
I mean, do I? That's that's a loaded question. Like, I feel like anyone who listens to this show, hopefully, after this conversation, has been encouraged that whether you liked Alien Covenant or not, whether you feel like it answered any deep, meaningful questions or not, you should be able to assuredly say that, if nothing else, you should be able to say that story is powerful and entertainment is not mindless. Bye-bye.
And we started the conversation. This was Screenfish.
This podcast has been a Real World Theology production. For more information, check out realworldtheology.com. And thanks for listening.
Now this is podcasting. Woo!
We are so excited to have back Mikey Fissel from Real World Theology. Welcome, Mikey.
Wow, this feels like an awkward first date.
It really does.
You guys really hit it off.
What's your favorite color?
You have so much in common.
Oh, man.
I really like cats. Yeah, that's why you're single. Game over, man. Game over.